first, but we'll kick off with Luke Ashworth, since he's going first, and his paper is entitled Anarchy Against Anarchism, the Global Anarchist Society as a Statist.
Yeah, over to you. Okay, yeah. I changed it ever so slightly. I actually made anarchism was kind of passive by doing, you know, the second one, you know, anarchy against anarchism. So I swapped them around with anarchism against anarchy, because it actually fit the paper better. So, okay. What I'm interested in looking at is the bottom line is an anarchist international relations possible, and what would it look like? And I kind of use the idea of the international anarchy as a way of getting into this. But I have to say right off the bat that my view of the affinity between anarchism and international anarchy, as you can probably get from the title of the paper, is that and there's very little affinity. In fact, quite the contrary. You know, from my point of view, I think, you know, it's an accident of language rather than anything else. And if there is an affinity, it's actually a negative one. So the main points of my paper, I'll be sort of trying to sum. This will be very much a summary. So I sort of direct you towards the main argument within the paper if you're interested in it. The main arguments are, the main points are that international anarchy is by and large a statist order. No, it is a statist order. It's a manifestation of state security at a global level. That the international anarchy, in many respects, serves as a warning to anarchists. But at the same time, in a more positive sense, anarchism can, and in fact should, offer an alternative to the international anarchy. Then, finally, the final point of the paper is to try and get a sense of what an anarchist IR might look like. So, the first thing I do in the paper is I try to sort of historicise the concept of international anarchy to understand it. Because even international relations experts don't know where it came from. It's not unusual. Most disciplines don't know their own histories. And really, in some respects, the international anarchy as a concept really doesn't emerge before industrialization. And in fact, in many respects, a concept of there being an international sphere, of there being a global sphere as we know it today, really is a product of the 1880s, 1890s to a large degree. There's a number of phases in terms of the development of the idea of an international anarchy. And I say I go into this in far more detail in the paper. I go into quite a certain amount of detail about the development of sort of the new geopolitics in the 1880s, 1890s, which was a response to industrialization and growing state conflict over resources and sort of the new imperialism of the late 19th century. But what's interesting, I think, from the point of view of the origin of the international anarchy and the idea of international anarchy as a subject to study, is that it emerges mainly as a way of criticising the new geopolitics that of people like Kjell in Sweden, of Ratzel in Germany, and so forth, of Semple in the United States, Frederick Jackson Turner in the U.S., who had presented geopolitics as a kind of a natural game. Dickinson, picture of it here, Dickinson picked the phrase anarchy, and again, this is why I say it's a linguistic, a matter of linguistic chance, as a synonym for chaos. It didn't mean it as disrespect to any classical anarchists. It was meant as a synonym of chaos. There's international chaos, and international chaos caused by states. States is a historic moment, he's a historian, it's a historic moment from the 15th century onwards, states create an international anarchy. And that's a problem. It needs to be replaced. It's a statist order. And international anarchy is a statist order linked very much to the development of the state. Now, his idea is very much to present international anarchy as a bad thing and something that needs to be replaced by ways of preventing war, preventing states from murdering us all in our beds. But it was the generation that followed people like Dickinson, Wolfe, Angel, who all used the concept of the international anarchy, where we begin to see the way international anarchy is used now in international relations. We see this particularly, it's more detailed in the paper, in terms of the 1940s, 1950s, with people like Martin White, Hans Morgenthau, who take the idea of international anarchy but say there's no way to solve it, so it's tragedy, because they still think it's bad. I mean, Morgenthau thinks that the balance of power is a terrible thing. But it's the only thing we've got. It's naturally unstable. But it's the later generation that we really think of as the people who talk about international anarchy, the people who emerge from the 1970s onwards, who take this earlier version of international anarchy and drop the tragedy bit. And I think the important thing to point out is it's here that international relations scholars start talking about international anarchy as being a defining feature of the international system. For Dickinson, it's just one of many aspects of global politics. So, so the international anarchy, effectively, the way it develops in international relations is as a kind of a statist order. Now, in the paper, I also engage with people who criticise international anarchy, particularly sort of recent people like Ashley and Milner and Wendt and so forth. I haven't got time to do that here. But suffice it to say that I suppose that the question that comes out of this is, does the international anarchy have to be about security in states? And the argument of the paper is yes, unfortunately it does. Now, let's leave the international anarchy aside for the moment. And what I want to do now, and I'll weave the international anarchy back into this, is that, and in the paper you'll actually see the connection of how I do this, but I haven't got time to go into it now. I want to look at two thinkers, two very different thinkers, one from international relations and one from activist anarchism, who actually has already been mentioned once in the last session, who I think actually have arguments that can be brought together to try and bridge the gap between IR and anarchism. One is Reinhold Niebuhr, very well known in IR, and the other one is Joe Freeman, who was mentioned in the last session. And starting with Niebuhr, I think there's Niebuhr is kind of put into the international sort of the realist grouping as box in international relations. But I think an important thing about Niebuhr was that his powerful opposition to social contractarian view, the sort of the Hobbesian view. To put it simply, the classic Hobbesian view is that people are bad, we need government to protect ourselves from ourselves, therefore government is good. And what Niebuhr said was the other way around, was that in fact individuals are moral and capable of self-sacrifice, of being moral, but collectivities aren't. Collectivities are actually amoral, or as he puts it in the title of his 1932 book, Moral Man, Immoral Society. So he reverses the Hobbesian argument. And just maybe to give an example of this, I'm not sure if you can see this cartoon here, but it's a couple in bed, and she's saying, you're strategically situated, but you're no longer vital to my interests. Now, the reason I put that up is, it's funny, because what she's saying there is totally out of context. And I think this gets over Niebuhr's point. If that was said by someone from the State Department at a press conference, you'd go, well, yeah, that's the right context for it. I understand. Yes, it makes sense. It's not funny. It's a statement of fact. But when you put it into an individual context, it doesn't make sense. And this is the whole point for Niebuhr, that there is this separation between a sort of a morally rich individuals and very morally, morally degenerate societies. And from this, what I take from this is that what Niebuhr, we bring out from Niebuhr is that there's a fundamental difference between a society of individuals, which is capable of being moral, and a society of societies, which isn't. Because individuals are capable of creating a moral society, but societies are not capable of creating a moral society of societies. You can see where this is linking back to the idea of the international anarchy. As a result, internally moral societies are not necessarily moral in their external relations. So being a good, nice group or a good, nice country doesn't make you good and nice in your relationship with other groups or other countries. Not necessarily. And the other one is Joe Freeman. I say they're the odd couple here. For those of you who know Joe Freeman, who was the author of The Tyranny of Structurelessness, a member of the Women's Liberation Movement, and the pamphlet itself is downloadable from several anarchist websites, and was also published as an academic journal as well at the same time. But what I take from her is her argument that structureless societies actually don't exist. If something claims to be structureless, it's actually informally structured, like this one. I think that both Medvedev and Obama are going to regret that photograph. But anyway, this is a classic example of a sort of a structureless society, if you like. It's actually informally structured. And the problem with informally structured societies is they they are effectively run by informal elites that, because it's informally structured, are not accountable. And weaker voices are silenced because there isn't a formal structure to allow weaker voices to speak up. In a way, this is a little bit like the argument from the webs that you were making earlier on, although, of course, Freeman doesn't go the full hog of that, all the way to saying what we need then is a bureaucratic system. I think in many respects what Freeman, when she was talking about women's liberation movements in California, was talking about is something actually that you can apply to the international anarchy. Here I'm kind of breaking Nibor's, I justify it in the paper, I'm not going to go into it now, but just I'm breaking Nibor's argument about the separation here of groups from individuals. But what she describes there really is the international anarchy in many respects. It's a structureless society where, because it's structureless, great powers are able to use informal structures to dominate, and the weak are voiceless. The weak are unable to make themselves heard. So, taking all of those aspects together, why does this lead us towards an anarchist IR? Well, first, from Nibor, what I take from Nibor is this idea that moral societies do not necessarily create moral societies of societies. So therefore, what you could say is sort of like a strange, weird reversal of Kant's argument that a society of devils would need laws. You could say the other way around, that a society made up of societies of angels would in fact behave like devils. Read the paper for where I developed Nibor's. I don't totally agree with Nibor, but I'm sort of taking a snippet from Nibor on that. And from Freeman, I take the idea that the international anarchy is elitist because it is informally structured. And this is the problem with sort of the way that the system of states is organised. And bringing these sort of two together, what I argue in the paper is that that there's a need for an anarchist international relations, and an anarchist international relations that looks for a structured anarchist alternative to international anarchy. From Nibor, we take the point that you can't rely on anarchist societies being nice to other anarchist societies, even though they may be moral within their communities. And from Freeman, the argument that if you are going to have a world of anarchist societies, that world has to be structured in order to make sure that you don't get sort of domination by one group or another. Working down then through towards the end of the paper, I talk about how, going back to the discussion ahead of the international anarchy, is that in many respects the international anarchy and what was being what I was just discussing at the beginning was a manifestation of state security in the global. I develop it a little bit more in the paper, but basically this is it. It's what happens when the kind of the night watchman state, when the idea of security and the state having a monopoly of security domestically sort of manifests itself on the international stage. But there is an alternative. There is also alongside the international anarchy, there is also a manifestation internationally of the welfarist aspects of the state. Through things like international organisations, through NGOs, through a whole series of sort of low politics organisations. And what I finish off by arguing is that for there to be an anarchist international relations, it should completely ignore the international anarchy and any sort of affinities based upon sort of false linguistic parallels, and should concentrate instead on a very different discourse and a very different sort of trajectory within international relations, which is along international organisations, transnational links, interdependence, and so forth. And that's it.
We've got a minute and a half to spare. What are we going to do with that time?
Over to you. You've got a 2-minute warning, 15 minutes, 17 minutes.
All right, so my paper touches on many of the same issues as that one does, except that I would say, although this might be misreading of what you just presented, with Jordan is in Tanzania, that's why he's not here. What Jordan and I are really looking at is sort of what's called a logic of practice. So logic of practice is sort of a concept in terms of logics of appropriateness, consequences, and so on, where what is not thought about actually informs what people do, right? They're not conscious of what they're doing. So we're looking at how the logic of practice applies to how structure is treated amongst IR scholars. So we're not actually making any claims about empirical anarchy or what goes on in the international realm, but just how the international realm has been sort of internalized and thought about in the practice of IR. And I should admit right now that both my paper and my presentation is a bit of a North American slant when I talk about mainstream IR. Things going on in Britain have actually acknowledged many of the criticisms that we make in our paper already, but seem to sort of perpetuate, especially in American IR. So we sort of had three objectives with this paper, which was, you know, A, to observe the practice of structure in IR, to critique or examine the limits and assumptions of that practice, and then to offer alternatives where they might be warranted. So as regards anarchism, we sort of observe that the practice of structure in IR associates, you know, taking in sort of the historical account we just got, associates anarchy a priori with violence and uncertainty as a structural kind of condition. And this goes for all of IR's major isms. Even constructivism in Wendt still makes these sort of a priori before any theorizing about, you know, different logics of anarchy come about. Essentially, anarchy is put out there as a system in which, because it's associated with violence and uncertainty, the units of the system, be they states, you know, whatever kind of unit we're looking at, non-state actors and so on, have to somehow transcend the problems of anarchy as a structural reality. This negative anarchy, so we developed this in the paper, the negative, what we call negative anarchy is what we're calling that, is rooted in IR's sort of reliance on social contractarian domestic analogy, views of sort of the state as the individual, taken out of sort of social contract theory. So in the paper there's sort of a sort of an elaborate placement of the various social contract theorists that are normally talked about in IR on a scale between what we call totality and anarchy. Not using anarchy in this sense in terms of like an anarchy as a structure, but anarchy as one pole on what you might call a dialectic that goes on in social contractarianism. So our examples of what anarchy might be on the very edge of the pole is if the human, you know, if the world only contained a single human being, so Adam or something like that, minus the God part, would be the ideal type, the Weberian ideal type of anarchy. Totality, on the other end, we use the example of the Borg or something like that, where so if you're not familiar with the Borg, it's a race in Star Trek where there's sort of no individuals, there's just sort of a collective identity that controls everything. So totality is sort of represents the sort of subversion of sort of the individual's freedom in anarchy to sort of collective constraints. It's the way social contractarianism is constructed. So depending on the thinker you look at, Hobbes, Locke, Kant, those guys, and then in a modern sense, even sort of Rawls adopts this kind of position as well. Depending on which one you look at, they make certain assumptions about humans in sort of an anarchical structure based on how they conceptualize anarchy in the individual. So for Hobbes, humans are actually contained sort of all the goodness that might come out of society. But they've got a few, let's say, you know, they have habits that, such as cheating and all that, that the structural constraint of anarchy selects and then sort of fills the value component of the structure of anarchy then gets filled by those bad habits of the individual. And you might move to Locke on kind of further into the anarchy side of the pole, where humans are, you know, in anarchy are more or less okay. They can have property and all that. There's just a few bad apples now and then that will, you know, have people, you know, give up the rights and enter into a social contract. So we generally speaking, these solutions, the social contractarian theorists propose, has to do with where they place things. So for Hobbes, of course, virtually any escape is good. And in fact, the further away from anarchy you can get, the better. So he ends up advocating sort of a very totalitarian or absolutist-looking regime. For Locke, since anarchy's sort of all right, the requirements of the state in terms of preserving everything that was good about anarchy when it introduces totality onto the individuals, there's a higher standard there. And essentially what IR has done, while it's explicitly couching many IR theories in the social contractarians, is they've taken this sort of cryptonormative aspect of the state of nature and applied it to the international system. So most of the, we're directed immediately to the problems of the structure of anarchy, violence, uncertainty, and then the solutions that are theorized out of that come from replicating, in various ways, introductions of totality. So introductions of the domestic source of authority insofar as they're possible in the international system. So if there's a Kantian friendship or a security community or a hierarchy via Lake, the book that just came out last year, usually these have to do with replicating either some sort of contract system or the sources of domestic authority using the state of nature. So what we end up doing in the paper is kind of saying, all right, that's all fine and good, but there have been there's movements in IR, especially in North America, sort of criticizing the use of anarchy as a organizing principle of international structure, especially in terms of its limits of explaining cooperation, different dynamics of cooperation, identity building at the international level, non-state actors, that kind of thing. So there's been a slew of sort of non-anarchy structures that have been pitched, networks, overlapping systems of security, governance, and so on. And there have also been, of course, criticisms that there isn't such a clear distinction between anarchy and the domestic realm, like Milner 1991. What we argue is that most of those criticisms of anarchy are actually criticizing this negative anarchy. And then what we can do as IR scholars, potentially, is broaden what anarchy does as an organizing principle so that we can capture some of those new waves in theory, identity building, and all that that is simply not captured by the sort of more minimalist negative anarchy that comes out of social contractarianism. So we make a pitch for what's called a positive anarchy. So I was hoping I could write this on the board with a marker, but I forgot my markers, and as it turns out, my passport. But anyway, my previous destination. So you might have on one side, if you can imagine it, negative anarchy. I'll stick it up on the board after, maybe. You have negative anarchy, and what Alex Wendt and some constructivists have done, and what some critical theory has done, thanks. In the middle is kind of try to say that anarchy might be multiply realizable. In the Wendtian multiply realizable anarchy, i.e. the logics of anarchy, the structure is still seen as sort of imbued with violence and uncertainty before you actually get to your logics. If you have more questions about that, you can ask me afterwards. It's kind of complicated. But if we go even further, if we kind of take Wendt, as he says, that anarchy is a tabula rasa, and really run with it in a way that Wendt doesn't, we can imagine anarchy actually as a structure in which units in the system, be they states or whatever, are actually free to determine their identities or to determine the sort of social construct of the system in a way that they aren't, in the way that people aren't in the domestic realm, if you make that distinction. So the idea behind positive anarchy is that it can be in some ways emancipatory. It's an emancipatory structure, not a constraining structure. If it's associated with violence, what positive anarchy does is it relocates where the sources of violence in the system might be elsewhere. So it's no longer part of the structure. It might actually be located in the units. So if we take positive anarchy and stick in some classical anarchists, and that's what we do in our paper, we do kind of a rundown of anarcho-syndicalism, individual anarchism, and so on. If we do that, often the source of violence actually becomes the sovereign state. And what it does at the domestic level, it then sort of reproduces the violence that exists at the domestic level into the international anarchy, a kind of Hegelian anarchy, if you will. If we take sort of some ideas of mutualism, and I can get into more details about this in the Q&A if you want, mutualism, we get a different picture of how international economics, propriety, and the sovereign state is sort of a territorial unit that safeguards property. How certain states in the system that are built around these principles interact with other states through multinational corporations and so on, following a Proudhon's sort of distinction between property and possession, right? Property being kind of what the state turns possession into. You can take that and kind of analogize it and operationalize it in terms of thinking about what the global financial order or global trade order does to some of the weaker states and say their natural resources and so on. And then just sort of a last thing we do is look at Max Stirner or this idea of egoistic political actors and how that might affect our understanding of something like democratic peace theory. Where it might not be that democracies themselves are intrinsically peace-loving or whatever, but that democracies can actually form if you take corporate agency in states as individuals, if you make that assumption, which is obviously problematic, that they may form a sort of a club of egoists that can only maintain itself by preying on other states, and that would explain the empirical finding that democracies tend to go to war. Just the worst dyad in the international system is between a democracy and levels of democracy, so if it's really democratic, and an autocracy, that you can measure it like that. So that's essentially what the paper does. It tries to broaden anarchy so we might be able to capture some of these other things that have been going on in IR research, such as ontological security and so on, without needing to reject anarchy as an organizing principle. Yeah. So.
Well, you're under time as well. No, we just keep talking. But thank you very much. Two great papers. Plenty to get stuck into, I'm sure. Next